My next guest on In the Arena is Maddie Clements, Director of the Australian Institute of Sport. Maddie's journey from psychologist to leading Australia's high-performance sports system represents in many ways what modern leadership requires, and that is the ability to create the conditions where people and performance can thrive. In the work I do with leaders, the aspiration to be authentic emerges almost inevitably. But there is an old saying, something like, if it's too obvious, it can't be trusted. And so it is with ideas around authenticity. Yes, leadership demands authenticity, but authenticity is an outcome. It's how we experience you, and it can never be seen as a starting point. And to reach it, we must cross the bridge of vulnerability, and there is no vulnerability without courage. And when you listen to Maddie, hers is a story of decades of courage that only leaders who can claim to be the first of a profound kind have been required to display time and time again. Sports leadership ranks have long reflected its historical origins, male-dominated, traditionally masculine in its values and expectations. And rather than being empowered to transform cultures, women in sports senior leadership are often required to adapt to these entrenched norms. And the role of psychologists was viewed through a particular lens. They were the people who provided services in support of leaders and athletes to reach their performance goals, but somehow their role was seen as separate from the real business of leadership. They were the people leaders consulted but were rarely asked to lead. So Maddie is transforming our understanding of leadership from the mechanics, you know, the systems, to the dynamics of human performance. And this, in her story, matters. Maddie brings a rare combination of courage, generosity, self-awareness, and joy to leadership. And her insight and wisdom, told with characteristic bravery, generosity, self-awareness, and joy, makes this episode an absolute ripper. Notebooks ready. Maddie Clements in the arena. I'm here today with in the arena with Maddie Clements, who, I'm going to look at the title, Executive General Manager AIS Performance. So tell me what that actually talks to.
What does it talk to? It's the AIS Director role.
Yes.
So AIS Director is fundamentally the boss of the Australian Institute of Sport.
Yeah. And how does that sit with you?
Depends on the day, but mostly I'm sort of finding my feet sitting into that role. We've spoken a little bit about it before. It wasn't something I expected to be sitting in the role for, but, yeah, pretty proud now, first female to ever hold the role. So it's a bit of an honour.
It's interesting because I expect it of you. But you didn't have it of yourself?
Yeah. No, it never crossed my mind that I would be the director of the Australian Institute of Sport.
Yeah, is that from a career aspiration point of view, or as in you never had a goal in regard to that, or is it because it's something you didn't think of yourself in terms of having that capacity or capability? And hopefully that sounded
okay. Probably, and I've been asked the question a lot. It's probably a combination of all of it. I don't think I've ever really had a clear career path. I take jobs because they're interesting and I think I can make a difference in the job. And then opportunities present and I think, oh, I'll give that a shot. That seems pretty cool, pretty interesting, see how it'll go. But the director of the Australian Institute of Sport wasn't one on the list that I thought was for me, because I have a very, very different background to everyone who's been in the job before. So it just hadn't crossed my mind.
Let's talk to your background a little bit, because I'm really interested in just where that takes you as it relates to modern leadership in that sense. You're a psychologist by training, had your own for a long time actually, Middle Edge.
Yeah.
So that was how long did you have your own organisation?
I reckon it was about 10, 15 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed running consultancy.
And that took you very close to elite sport, didn't it?
Yeah. Mostly pro coach, so spent a lot of time in AFL, cricket, bit in netball, bit in soccer.
Yeah. So the professional codes, which really in that case were the ones you could actually afford to pay, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, though, at the time, because a lot of the work we were doing was leadership and culture and setting up wellbeing services. So yes. I think at that point in time, they were probably a fair bit ahead than your Olympic, Paralympic and Commonwealth Games sports in that thinking. Absolutely had more money, but I think the leadership at the very top of the clubs, for instance, were thinking, okay, what do we need to do? We need to do something for our players, our coaches, whereas Olympic and Paralympic sports have probably come to that a little bit later.
Do something for the players in... Because ultimately the professional sporting codes are going to be fairly selfish as it relates to or not selfish is probably the wrong word, more myopic as it relates to performance, particularly in that era and as someone who was involved in it. The importance of ideas around well-being were just starting to come into play. Were you able to talk to ideas of well-being as it related to performance?
Yeah.
Was that
absolutely. Because we started the work, a lot of the work we were doing in the, particularly the football clubs with the leadership teams and all the coaches was based on emotional intelligence.
Yes.
So the Baron measurement at that point in time and all the competencies of that self-awareness, interpersonal skills. And when you think about it, those things are things that create well-being in a culture. And I think whether we knew it or not or the clubs knew it or not, that was thinking about how do we create high-performance cultures, high-performance programs where well-being is fundamental to them, because no one can tell me different. Well-being is fundamental to sustainable high-performance success, not just for athletes and players, coaches, staff, et cetera. You can have one-off great performances, but you can't have it sustainably. And in the system I work in now, if you don't have well-being at your core, why would people stay around? They've got better things. They're not getting paid the big bucks or anything to be an Olympian or a Paralympian, inclusive of the coaches. So you've got to have well-being at the core.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's – and there's a couple of things come to mind there. The first one is the recognition of that from the athlete point of view. Mm. And if it's a professional athlete – well, there's clearly we're heavily invested in this person at a team-based level, so we want to get the best from this because that helps them play their role in the team in regard to that to the best of their ability. It seemed to me there was a fairly significant transition where we started thinking about other people's well-being as it related to that, including – and I think of you in this regard, by the way, as in someone from your background who – would be asking a lot of themselves in regard to playing the role that you are as a leader, as someone with a very much a strong well-being background, but also obviously the coaches where you would see, I would say, and this is definitely my experience of it, people burning the candle at both ends in just about all aspects of their life, but asking out their players to be in good shape by match day.
And if you listen to what you just said, that doesn't make sense, does it? So it's okay for the athlete or the player to have well-being, but everyone else, don't worry about it. That's completely illogical. I understand why the original focus was and has been on athletes and players, ROI, players' unions, and that's where I originally came from, AFL Players Association. They drove the importance of well-being, and it was absolutely the right thing to do. But in actual fact, it's the right thing for everyone in high performance. It's not just for that group. So I think, and even now in this industry I work in now, we started with the focus being on athlete well-being. That's what there was a greater appetite to learn and understand. And you know coaches as well as me, sometimes they're a little bit more difficult to bring on a journey on things. So absolutely start with what does this mean for the athlete group? How do you build this into performance? And then it's almost by stealth, others thinking, okay, well, maybe I could benefit from that a little bit, and then moving it into coach wellbeing, high performance directors, CEOs, et cetera, et cetera. But the focus, if you start with the bit that you're going to have the least amount of resistance for, I think then you can create the understanding and the momentum to shift the culture.
Yeah. And where my mind goes straight away on that is just the ideas around just the stress element to it and the capacity for particularly coaches under pressure. And I think of your role a little bit like this too, where it's highly measurable at some point that you're going to be, you're asking for a lot of money from a government to try and produce an outcome. The outcome, which I assume is the scoreboard in many cases, is the number of gold medals we win at an Olympic game. And the stress associated with just outcome-focused roles where at some point the spotlight will swing. If it's a team-based sport, it might swing from player to player to player, but ultimately there's one figure that it will come back to, and that's the coach. And if we then say, okay, from an organisational point of view such as the Australian Institute of Sport, well, that spotlight could easily come back to you in your role. So the stress element of it, talk me through some of the elements of well-being as it relates to the stress. So people listening to this, one of my favourite lines is, you've never led unless you've woken up in the morning and your first thought's fuck.
Well, I'm going okay then.
Well, that's good. That's good. So how do you think of stress from a well-being point of view, and what things would you talk to when it comes to coaches, and then hopefully some application to self in regard to that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think stress, the high performance sport, there's always going to be stress. So it is not made for the lighthearted. Yes. And I think that's that every time I've said that, that comes across as elitist or egotistical. It's not that. If you're after a workplace or a role where you can pretty much predict what the day is going to look like, you can go to bed at night or go into the weekend and not worry about it, elite sport's not for you.
Yeah.
But lots of people thrive, like me. I thrive in that. I like, for want of a better word, the chaos or the unpredictable nature of the role. There is not one single day that looks like the day before for me, and I quite enjoy that. It's all about problem solving and taking that approach in, which I think I learnt from my psychology background.
Mm.
What's the problem in front of you? Seeking to understand that, seeking to hear what the person or the group of people, however big or small that is, listening and going, okay, what's their view of this problem? And then how do we work through it collectively to get something that's deemed as pretty okay for all parties? That's a skill I got from psychology, absolutely. Yeah. So that sort of listening, diagnosis, working out a treatment plan in that case, and then helping the individual implement that treatment plan. That's not actually vastly different to what I do now.
No.
So I find a level of comfort and confidence working through problems. And I think also what my psychology taught me was to be able to separate myself from that, because if you took on every single client's issue, you would not be able to do your job successfully.
Yeah, talk me through that.
So, I've thought a heap about this. So, I really enjoyed my time working as a psychologist. I loved the intimacy of someone feeling so comfortable with you that they would tell you their deepest, darkest secret and want you to help them through that. That's a pretty special thing, a really special thing.
Well, they're almost coming to you at a time of most need.
Absolutely.
And which can be quite draining for you, as in you may have, you know, five people in one day coming to you at a time of most need.
And it might be the first time they've ever told someone.
Yeah.
So that's really special and such a privilege.
It is.
But you can't take that emotional burden on, because then you wouldn't be your best self to help that person through the best chances of implementing the strategies, et cetera, and healing, for want of a better word. So that, and I know it sort of sounds callous when I say it, but it's not my problem. My job is to help them through the process, and that's no different to the way I approach a lot of the leadership problems. I'm there to listen, I'm there to understand, and then work through it with absolutely a level of empathy, because I think if you don't have empathy, you don't actually always hear what the real issue is, and you don't have a genuine want from the stakeholders around the table to resolve the issue or get a better outcome, etc. But it's pretty much the same philosophy.
Yeah, no, that's powerful. There's a couple of things come to mind. The first one is it's almost the perfect training for leadership.
I think so. I'm biased.
Yeah, no, clearly, yeah. But in terms of modern leadership, in what it asks of you.
Yeah.
Because if we talk about leadership at the most fundamental level, and you and I have spoken about this, is that I think of the biggest errors I made is when I didn't respond to what the situation was asking of me in that moment. And it mostly came through a lack of connection with the group itself. And from a CEO point of view, you can quickly become alone. And one of the things I coach to now is yes, you're going to be lonely, and I'm sure you have a sense of that at different times, but it doesn't mean you're alone.
No.
And so even from a client perspective, is often they would have felt lonely, I would assume, but you are in the room are basically saying you're not alone in that sense. Yeah.
And I think, Cam, one of the fundamental skills that I think I bring to the table for leadership is empathy.
Yeah.
I genuinely am curious, and I genuinely want to understand what the other group, stakeholder group, what they need in order to move forward or be successful. Mm. And most of the time we're not too far off. It's seeking to understand and going, okay, here's some easy wins. We're so close on here, let's just move ahead on that. And these things were a bit further away, but actually seeking to understand what the barriers are is really, really important. And then what are some of their solutions they consider? Yes. And I can't always meet those solutions. Obviously money is one that comes up frequently, yeah, or just give us more money and it'll be and I can't do that
all
the time.
And it's never the solution anyway.
Correct. But what else? Oh, well, if we sort some more resources collectively, half the time we can do that.
Yes.
A lot of the problems aren't as big as people think they are.
So coming from a place of empathy, yeah, was the second thought in many ways. And so when I think about that, in terms of actually putting yourself into a place of leadership and people actually trusting you, giving you the levers, if you like, particularly in the role that you're playing now, which has very strong commercial elements to it. The first thought people would have is that, you know, to play a role like that, you need to be someone who's got a strong commercial background.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, because the people who are seeking to make the appointment in the first place are most likely people who have a strong commercial background. Yet you present yourself as someone, you say, well, really my superpower in all of this is that I'll come from a place of empathy, because in my view that gives us the best chance of creating the outcomes that are best for everyone, whether it's for the athletes, whether it's for the, you know, government funding, whatever it might be. How challenging has that been for you to put yourself forward into leadership roles saying, I don't have that commercial?
Yeah.
In the ways that people might judge it.
Absolutely. I think there is an assumption that if you're in a role like mine that you've got some commercial background. I don't have that. I recognise that it'd be 10 years ago now, which is why I did the executive MBA, because I thought maybe that would help me understand what I don't have, what that experience did other than age me significantly, was because the kids were only, I think, 3 or 4 years old at that point. So the timing of it wasn't well thought out from my side of things. But what it did teach me was, in actual fact, the language that I learnt through the exec MBA was new, but the frameworks weren't vastly different and the knowledge base wasn't vastly different to a lot of the stuff I was already doing. It's just because my whole background has been in sport, I didn't have the same terminology, but a lot of things were pretty similar, and we do a lot of those things in sport. We just call it something different. So I think that helped create a level, increased level of confidence. And in my current role, what I've learned is it's still problem solving.
Yes.
So we got the biggest investment in Australian sports history a couple of months ago. The Prime Minister announced it pre-Paris.
Yeah, give me the number. It's a good number.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's pretty, yeah, it is pretty good. So we so we got a lot more money than we've ever had before. And pleasingly, several other countries are very jealous of us. I caught up with the Netherlands last week and they were like, that was amazing. But it was also it was an interesting learning process for me because we absolutely had a whole heap of terminating measures, so we didn't want to go backwards, but we also needed to explain what the compelling argument was to not only have those terminating measures renewed but also an increase. Measures?
What does that mean?
So terminating measures is you get an amount of money for a period of time and it's attached to certain outcomes.
Yes.
And ours were attached to performance pathways, athlete wellbeing and engagement, a couple of other areas. And it was a significant portion of our overall funding.
Is that right?
A significant portion. The rest was base appropriation. So it would have meant if we hadn't have got that, a whole heap of sports high performance programs would have not been able to receive any money.
Yeah.
So we needed to get that and once again explain the impact of what we had done and my predecessors importantly had done during their time in leadership, the impact of that money, and then what else we needed. And I think what we did was explain really clearly something that is absolutely true that will shift the dial for Australian sport and has a bigger emphasis on the Australian population, and that is that we have inequity we've historically had inequity in our para programs.
Mm-hmm.
And as an Australian, we need to do better.
All notions of fairness and decency and, you know, the most fundamental values that we somehow aspire to but have to be shaken back to
absolutely.
At different times.
And it's still high performance. It's unashamedly about performing on the big stage when it matters, and that's Olympic, Paralympic and Commonwealth Games. And we've done so many good things many decades ago in Paralympic sport, but other countries have caught up and actually surpassed us, and we need to do better.
So the conversations you've been having for the last 20 years now have a power and a relevance that perhaps they didn't in previous generations.
Mm.
But what I also hear from you there is that the concept of you, again, sitting with a client, back to your psych background, where really you're going to ask them to change, aren't you? Like at the most fundamental level, if you're sitting there with someone, say, look, something's going to have to change here.
Yep.
The change needs to then build around some form of compelling conversation that you have with them, which is then going to ask them, and then you're going to have to sow the seeds, but also hopefully there's enough fertile soil in that person to sort of germinate it in some way, because you know it's going to be hard work for them.
Yep.
So that fundamental, and that's roundabout framework, I'm thinking, is that same framework is basically what you've applied to one of the biggest funding debates that, you know, you will have in your time in sport, certainly.
And I think the important bit of what you said then is when you're sitting with a client, I can want it for them, but it's ultimately their call.
Yes.
I can't make them do anything. It's completely their call.
Well, you've been learning leadership right from the start, would be my take. It just hasn't been the call. And then you've had to try to convince people.
Yeah.
And my assumption is, just watching, seeing your career path, because you came into the Institute of Sport based on your wellbeing background, that what's happened over time is people have recognised that what you bring from that perspective is, in fact, leadership. And my understanding is perhaps have seen something in you that you had not yet seen in yourself. Yeah. Would that be fair?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We spoke, my chair at the time when I went into the interim role. AIS Director CEO role, which I ended up staying in for 18 months. The chair, Josephine Zucker, who I've got an immense amount of time for, wonderful person, she called me and I thought she was calling about something we had done online. And then at the end of the conversation, this is my recollection of it, she said, and we were wondering, the board and I were wondering if you'd be acting CEO. And I got off the phone call because we were at home, it was in the middle, one of the many Melbourne lockdowns, and I said to my husband, I think she, Josephine, our chair, just asked me to be the acting CEO, but I might have got it wrong, so I'll just wait and see if she calls back. So I genuinely just did not expect it. Mm. Yeah.
Did you aspire to it?
I like the idea of leadership. I like leadership, and I like the idea of leadership because I think that's how you make change.
Yes.
Because if you genuinely, and as I said earlier, I've always taken jobs where I think they'll be interesting and I can do something meaningful. And I think leadership enables you, just by definition, you can, and role title, you have the greatest chance of making change. So yes, but the title is probably less important. It's the ability to, in this case, the opportunity to change and direct high performance sport in this country.
And it probably needs the two things, doesn't it? It does need the title. Yeah, and we can lead from all forms of unexpected play. And ultimately, as a leader, your role is to, you know, build leadership within the organisation anyway, which I'm sure is part of your process. But if you don't bring the intention and behaviours to match the title, you know, that it's not going anywhere in that sense. And we've spoken before about this idea of perhaps we grew up where leadership was a far more directed, controlling way, where there was, you know, you're expected to line up behind a boss's view of the world. How have you seen that change?
I think there's still pockets, absolute pockets of that. I have a very, very different style. And it's driven by my belief that it's an absolute privilege to work in elite sport. We're hardly solving world peace or cancer or solving cancer. So it should be fun. It should be fun. And I believe I demonstrate that through how I lead. There's points in time where you need to be serious, and there's also points in time, let's just have a joke, have some fun. Mm. So I think there's that, but absolutely the way I lead is through all my people development and people management background. You bring in the other expertise. So we talked about, I don't have a commercial background. Absolutely, I don't. I'd say my financial acumen isn't my super strength, but I've got people in my team that have got that super strength. I don't need to be a unicorn.
Mm.
I need to have a unicorn team.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because I think there is that, you know, just even a simple idea for leaders, what are you building your game around?
Mm.
We'll build around the stuff that you're naturally drawn to and you're good at and you bring something special to. Be aware of what you don't bring, but also make yourself available to the sorts of feedback and the conversations that we need to have, because there's things that sit in between which are blind spots.
Absolutely.
You know, where you think you're bringing something that you're not bringing in regard to that. And how do you make yourself available to that type of feedback? Have you worked through that for yourself?
Yes. So I seek feedback from my leaders regularly through when we have fortnightly catch-ups and frequently, and it does absolutely throw them when they're new to being the team. At the end of it, I'll say, so have you got any feedback for me?
Yeah.
And if we do it enough times, they start giving feedback.
Get better. Yep. Yeah.
Obviously the first couple of times they're not going to give, it's just superficial feedback, but once you move into a behaviour of, you're asking me for feedback, but I'm also going to ask you for feedback.
Mm.
So we're going to role model the same behaviours that we're asking the broader team to do. And in actual fact, we talk about in high performance sport all the time about giving feedback. Yeah. Yet
we think nothing of it.
Yeah, but that's
nothing of it. In fact, correct. It's a total expectation.
Correct. Yeah. But then when you move into a management or leadership role, for some reason it stops. That makes no sense to me. But if you're an athlete or player and coach, it's a day to day, hour by hour. Skill and strategy. So I think you just that's one of the strategies. I'll constantly move it into the one-on-one feedbacks, and then I'll ask for broader feedback from the leadership group and make sure the team, the leadership meetings are structured so that either someone else is leading them or chairing them at different points so I can partake in them.
It's one of the hardest roles, I think, is when you're leading a team like that is you've got to sort of like chair the group and chair the meeting, but you're also the boss in that way. And you can be the person who closes out the conversation at the very time where, and to have someone else other than you have that responsibility over a period, I think is actually a good thing to do. And it obviously gives them a certain experience as well. But I think it's a very underestimated skill, that role of being the leader, the CEO or the director of a group of people, where you're actually asking for an open conversation in one way or another, but at the same time the ultimate responsibility sits with you. It's different to chairing a board, for example. That's just a facilitation of a good quality conversation, when to start, when to finish. But generally you're talking about something where a decision needs to land at some point, you know, and people have got a natural bias towards their own areas and all of that happens.
But I also think it starts with 101 self-awareness. If you know just by title when you go into a meeting that people's natural or regular response will be to look out of the corner of the eye or wait to see what she says, then the art of what I learned when I 101 first year of psychology is to sit very comfortably in complete silence and someone else will crack before you.
So
I'm okay to sit there and just wait.
As I said, it's a perfect leadership training. because I remember I'd come into rooms at different times and I'd say, never mind me. Well, you're the CEO, mate. We're minding you. You're in the room. Like we can't get away from that fact. Yeah. And you see the conversation totally change.
Yeah.
And because you do cast, a big shadow in that way. And so part of it is how you go about reducing the shadow in that sense.
And I think there's little things you can do, Cam. And I know when there's more junior staff that come into a meeting and there's some absolutely fantastic talent we've got in our team, I'll make sure I either send them a text message beforehand or during the meeting or give them a call before and go, we need to hear what you've got to say.
That's fantastic.
So there's little things like that, or you follow up afterwards, that was a ripping comment you made. Excellent, like really made me think.
Mate, that's outstanding. It reminds me, Nick Maxwell, who we interviewed on the podcast, he would, as captain of Collingwood, would say to a young player, when the group comes in, I'm going to ask you a question, here's the question. About a drill they're doing or something like that, just to prepare yourself. So just give it a bit of
confidence.
Thought. Yeah. And so if you just called the player out unexpected in front of a group, particularly if it's a young player, well, you could easily get something other than, but the person's, they've had to think about it, they've had to go through, why are we doing this drill? What benefit are we doing? Are we doing it well? Whatever might have been going through. And as soon as he mentioned that, I thought, what is the application potentially for a CEO? And you've just explained it.
It's 101 teaching, isn't it? So I don't think there's any benefit in putting someone on the spot to embarrass them. No one benefits from that. And in actual fact, the ripple effect of everyone else seeing you've done that, you can pretty much predict how the rest of the next couple of meetings, subsequent meetings will go, because you've just embarrassed someone.
Yeah, well, no one, everyone thinks they're going to get cold called. I just had a repressed memory when I was doing my MBA. There was a guy by the name of Bob Officer at the Melbourne Business School, and it was corporate finance, of which I had no. If I had to do an exam, I think I passed the exams okay, but if I had to do the exam tomorrow, I'd get like 3%. I just did enough at the time to get through. And he was a cold caller, and there was like 30 in the room, say. No, it was only about 20. So you're a decent chance of getting called up. And I'd already been a CEO of an AFL club at this point. I'm doing my MBA and I'm having sleepless nights about being called up before Bob Officer's corporate finance subject. Just that idea of the potential of being embarrassed in front of your peers.
I know teachers still do it now in class, and I don't understand. That does not benefit anyone, and because you're not learning.
No, there's no, it's just shaming basically.
Yeah.
So even the fact that you go to the idea of teaching as a leader, and one of my favourite lines, are you a teacher or a teller, is, in terms of leadership. And I think telling seems very efficient at the time, or very effective at the time, because you can get the person in and out of the room really quickly. But the obviously yeah. coaching, teaching seems to be a big part of how you
teaching. My mum was one of the longer serving prep teachers in Victoria school history, and when I was little, I used to go in and watch her teach.
Is that right?
Yeah. We used to get dragged in when there was a dragged in to help out and whatever. But there is something in teaching, isn't there? That what it can elicit, the ways and that individualised way of what does that person need over what does that person need, etc. And I think that is leadership. If you have a blanket style, you're going to miss opportunities. And I appreciate as a leader, you have a huge number of people, so there's still that need to go wide, but then how do you bring it down to an individual moments, which is more time consuming, but I think you get more bang for buck from that.
Neil Craig talked about connection before correction
yep.
in his podcast. You know, I think of often situations where all the need for leadership to be situational, what this conversation requires from me, as opposed to someone who's in the role for 18 months compared with someone who's been doing the job for 10 years.
Yes.
You know. And the 10-year person mightn't be right, but you'll need to be a bit more compelling perhaps in that sense. So even ideas around, I think of ideas around clarity as an outcome now. People say, I need more clarity. Well, the chances are you need more connection.
Belonging. I think belonging is something that's really underrated in culture. If people belong to something greater than their own self-interest, then you can create something magical, because you're all aligning behind something, and you may ask, and you've got greater chance when you ask for them to put their self-interest aside that they will, because they can see that they belong to something greater. People do wonderful things when they belong to something.
Have you ever, as you've come through the ranks, struggled to find that piece, the belonging piece?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at different points it's been, to be frank, gender related, because I've been the only female in the team or in the room. So it has been difficult for me to work out how do I belong to this, because I don't look the same as everyone else. I don't have the same athletic background, football background. I haven't played the game. So how do I belong to it? So sometimes it has felt like you're a couple steps removed outside the circle. Yeah, and that is difficult.
How did you negotiate that for yourself? I don't know if negotiate is the right word, but how did you find a place for yourself in that sense?
I think probably in one example, I didn't really ever belong. So at the right time, it was time for me to leave. And then at other times, it's been working out. I don't look the same, I don't have the same background, but I feel like I can contribute this way, and spending a bit more time individually in those examples, some of the more influential people in there or more senior people in there to understand where's my value add and how can they understand what that value add is, but also how does that help me understand it? Because if they can explain it or help me articulate it, that means you're more likely to be able to get it clear in your head.
Did you ever feel what aspects often, coming from a place of absolute privilege in regard to this, I've never had anything close to the experience you've had, but still struggled with ideas around identity and belonging without near the layers that you're talking to there. And one of my responses in those times were almost to try and create an identity for myself and then do my best to fit into that identity and realise that it was actually an exhausting experience trying to create that. Like for example, I was a young CEO, and I wanted to be seen as far more forceful than what I was. I looked like I was a member of a boy band rather than being a CEO of an AFL club, And it literally felt like that. I was younger than the players or whatever. So I thought, and I definitely overcompensated to make a point. Because I was terrified of being seen as, and it was in a generation where people, he's going to be too soft or he's going to be too this. And I never felt that, by the way, because I always felt that I was going to confront what I needed to confront. But there's no doubt that I amplified aspects of myself. Without near yeah, the gender dynamic that you're talking to here, and I'm sure other forms of dynamic, you know, quite apart from that. So did you ever find yourself in that place where you were almost creating identities for yourself?
Absolutely. The first 3 months when I was in the acting AIS director role, I decided to take on the identity of my predecessors, who I have a great deal of respect for. They've done wonderful things, but they're not me. Yeah. So being the first female into the role and someone with my quite different background, I decided, well, I just need to behave like they have.
They did, yeah.
And it was incredibly unenjoyable.
In what way? What did you?
It was exhausting. So it was. Yeah. It was. So I'm not going to muck around. It's not that I muck around all the time, but I enjoy going work. I enjoy talking to people. Yeah. I think there's
an obvious sense of fun in what you bring.
Yeah. I think having humour is really important. So I decided not to do any of that because I've got to be very serious. It's a very serious job. All this taxpayers' money, and we've got Olympic and Paralympic medals. So I've got to be very, very serious. And it was incredibly unenjoyable. It was exhausting. I was coming home from work just absolutely exhausted by the end of the week and genuinely thinking, I hate this. This is horrible. I'm going to go back to my substantive role. The sooner the better. It was completely unenjoyable. And I was also focused on all the elements of the role that I don't feel as confident in, which at that point in time was investment, whereas now I feel really confident in investment. But I was just focused on all the things that I knew weren't my superpower.
Yeah. And was there any feedback given to you during that period of time in regard to?
Absolutely. So my husband, who clearly saw that I was fairly miserable during the job, and several of the staff, maybe not directly, but indirectly referenced how I was behaving. So it was a bit of a wake-up call, and then I thought, well, I'm not going to be in the job for that long, so I might as well just do it the way I would prefer to do it, be me, because I'm going back to my substantive job anyway, so I'm just going to be me and enjoy it for the short period of time. And then I was in it for 12, 18 months.
So you see, by taking the sort of the fear and judgment out of it, you actually become a much better leader because
absolutely.
Of it.
Yeah.
You gave yourself permission to be you.
Correct.
Really. Yeah.
Correct.
And it's much easier from my experience.
Oh, it was way easier and so much more fun.
Yeah.
And I actually was able to think better because I wasn't so tied up in my head thinking about all the things I wasn't good at and how hard it was to stay very serious all the time. And not smiling and whatever, because I'd got feedback at some point in my journey about that I smile a lot, and I had interpreted that I needed to stop smiling so much because I couldn't be taken seriously. So then I decided to weave that into the first 3 months as well. So I'm going to be deathly serious the entire time. And
I still deal with people who I'll be coaching them, and there'll be certain things we'll talk about, and they go, "Well, I'm not a people person," and you're thinking.
Statement.
It's a big cool mark. You're certainly presenting as a people person, and they'll go back to some form of feedback they got at some stage of their life. So they go, "Oh, you need to be like a back room, not up front person, because you're clearly not a people. You're not a leader. You're not." And in some cases, it literally was their student counselor or their university careers advisor or something along those lines, or they worked at an accounting firm and it was someone in their HR people and culture area, and they've given this idea of identity and talking to the one that we seek to create for ourselves is exhausting enough, let alone one which we've actually believed that someone else someone else that's created for us in that way. And then there's a wonderful line in Bono's book Surrender, and he basically says something along the lines that he found the hardest thing to be on stage is you, is the line he uses. And as soon as I thought, that's from a leadership perspective, particularly when you're coming into it having dealt with, say, the gender dynamics, I'm sure there's not many males who would have ever been told, "Oh, you smile too much." Like,
I'd be surprised.
It wouldn't have happened. Yep. You know, it's just crazy shit, really, that somehow that wouldn't actually be seen as a positive, that you could actually come into a room with all the tension, all the issues, you know, all the weight of the responsibility that leadership brings and actually bring, a positive demeanour. You're showing up in a good way.
Absolutely. And, I think now, and I don't think when I was told that it was meant to shape the way I thought for a decade later, but it did shape
that effect, that
because I thought, oh well, maybe if you're a leader, you've got to be serious the whole time. But I actually think now, as I said, I enjoy work and I enjoy being around people, but also you can disarm someone very quickly and put them on a back foot in a meeting very quickly through a bit of a smile and asking them something personal that they've said in passing in the previous meeting, and they may not have even known they've said it or they've forgotten, etc. But I've remembered, and then I can say, "Oh, how was your grandkid? I think they had a game on the weekend." And already, if they've come in combative, they're on the back foot because they're going to have a go at the person that's just smiled at them and remembered what their grandson or granddaughter has done. That changes the dynamic completely.
And again, that probably goes back to your psych background, where you might be seeing three or four or five people in a day, and you do have to, I'm sure you have your notes and you have whatever, but you do have to have a certain form of recall that brings you back into a place of connection within seconds, because you've got an hour with them.
Absolutely.
And you've got to make, probably 45 minutes really with them, and that 45 minutes might well be the most important 45 minutes of that person's month.
Absolutely.
In some cases.
And I still see some of those because when I was consulting as a psych, I was in elite sport. I still see some of those people now who are in senior roles, et cetera, and it is amazing. I think I will never, ever disclose that they were a client.
The conversations you had.
But many of them will come up and say in front of others, "Oh, Maddie was my psychologist." And that's pretty special.
That's deep.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing, I'm interested in your perspective on this, is that having been that for them, now when they look at you in terms of the role that you're playing, how have you had to overcome certain perceptions of you that you are only that thing?
Yes.
Particularly with a really the idea, and my wife is a clinical psych, and it's, and to even tell you my wife's a clinical psych, or they meet her and they know she's a psych, that you can almost see it change. You can see you probably had that all the time. It's like, when someone meets an accountant, they don't go into that place, or when someone meets it, I'm sure a physio gets it. I say,
"Yeah, I've got a bit of first. Yeah, can you check this out?"
It's quite hammy at the moment. Is that, even as a leader now, does that bring some sort of perception with it? I'm a senior leader in an organisation, but I'm also a psychologist.
I think so. I think there's pros and cons. There's always the jokes. Can you read my mind? I can read my husband's mind and my kids' mind. I know what they're up to. Can I read? But there's also with the psychologist in a leadership role, I'm not going to get every people element of the job right. And there's, I think, sometimes a belief, well, you've got that background, so you're going to nail every element of it. And of course, I've stuffed it up multiple times. So of course, I've made a bad appointment or not managed a situation as well as I could, not manage my own emotions at different times. Like, I'm not immune to the people side of things, but I think sometimes there is that belief that you're trained in that you need to be better at that side,
and a judgment which will come with that. It does bring back at times when I made errors that I don't have regrets, but I definitely have reflections, and sometimes the reflections on issues which were quite career defining for me were often those ones where rightfully the person says, "You should have known better. You should have known better," knowing what you know. Do you have those moments where you judge yourself in that way?
Yep. I think by nature I'm a very internally self-critical person, and once again it has helped, it's aided me in many ways, but also can get in the way. So I will leave a day of work or a week of work And I can go back through that entire week and go, I didn't nail that conversation. That's where I stuffed that one up. I should have done that better. And I will go through it very critically and go, I missed the moment there. I should have read that body. In hindsight, I could see that person wasn't on board or that meeting was going off wire. So I'm very self-critical of that.
Is that self-critical or just a practice of reflection? I suppose it depends on what you're reflecting on.
Depends. I think it depends. It can go incredibly self-critical,
yeah.
And then it. But also, I think it's a good practice to have to go back and review what could have been done better. I think I am a product of working in high performance sport that I spend very, very little time reflecting on what's been achieved. But I do think that's something that our industry does very poorly. So we will, even now, we've come through the most successful Olympics ever at the Paris Games, and we're just straight into the next thing.
No, it moves on quick,
doesn't it? It does. And that's the nature of elite professional sport.
Yeah.
But then that is a style I have about me, and I received feedback from some staff members, some leaders about 4 or so years ago that I did not spend enough time celebrating some of the wins, and they needed that from me. That's good feedback. That was really helpful.
That is great feedback. I relate exactly to that. Even a couple of things come to mind. I don't want to go into coach mode, but I'm going to. ideas around blame, I think, are really powerful, and you would be all over that. And one thing about blame is it finds friends really quickly, and I think it also somehow finds, you know, it's like the – I love The Simpsons, and they've got the devil Homer and the angel Homer on each shoulder. Yeah. You know, sometimes we're letting the devil Homer take over a little bit, and I think that's the blame piece, you know, and the self-blame idea. And so my little way of – and I used the terminology before. I said I've got reflections, but I haven't got regrets. Right. Yeah. And so even in my little system around that is just around the journaling, because I think if we're just letting it happen in our heads, it tends to somehow circle back to some form of self-blame and almost recriminating ways of thinking about ourselves. And so I actually, and the little line I use is if we're under thinking, read or listen to a podcast or go into a learning space, but if we're overthinking, write. And so I always just start with three questions: what happened, what now, what next? So what happened, you know, and I just start writing. Well, it was a good conversation. Yeah. Yep. What am I going to do with that now? You know, what's the now piece with that?
Yep.
Well, the now might be you have to go back and apologise to someone. The now might be going back to someone and say that conversation didn't go as well as I thought it would have. You know, how are you feeling about it? And sometimes when I did the now piece, I was the only one thinking that. The person said, oh, I haven't thought about it since.
No, correct.
But a lot of the time it would be, I have given that a bit of thought. We did rush through that, or I did feel a bit wounded at the end of that conversation.
Yeah.
And then the what next is then, well, next time we're in that situation, what do I now, how would I handle that differently? You know, what mechanics do I need to put in place? You know, how aware of the dynamic do I need to be? Was I distracted in that moment? Am I allowing myself to be that? So the what happened, what now, what next? And it becomes such a strong way of thinking that I now actually, even in leadership meetings, they were the only three questions that I wanted people to come into the room with.
Yeah, right.
What happened, what now, what next? Yep. So what happened isn't a conversation about what we've done. It's a conversation about what you've learned.
Yes.
And how do we bring those learnings into the room so we can all benefit from it. Yeah.
I like that.
And so it becomes this, and for me it was, you know, literally I finish meetings, I go, what happened, what now, what next? You know, with a good, if I've had a good, just to remember sometimes what we had to do next. But it mostly came because I think I had definitely the same sort of mindset of going into a place of blame, and the blame was very rarely external. It was mostly internal. Yeah. There was a lot of blame happening out in the world because sport always creates that. but it was, I've written a piece on this where I literally was driving home from a game at Fremantle, and game we should have won. And I said to Cecily, sitting in the front seat, I think I'm fucking the whole thing up. And she didn't say anything. And then she got out of the car, and I was expecting oh, no, Dale, you're doing a great job, or, you know, I believe in you. There was none of that. It was, we've moved our family from Perth here for you to do this job. And the minute you start thinking like that, you know, I know there's a whole lot of people who are making sacrifices here. There's a whole lot of people, and it really straightened me up in that, and that little system started to evolve from that process.
I really like that. I don't think I write enough stuff down. I think, I like that model, the three.
Which just connects ideas. Yeah. It's just so simple, because we just have so many thoughts going through our mind, and what there's a tendency to do is to ruminate on what's happened, to overly concern ourselves over what might happen, when really all we can control is how we are in the moment, in that moment now, and how we respond in that moment, and. Yeah, even in, say, preparation for today or whatever it might be, is just how you actually stay present now. How do you bring – and so for me it might be how did I handle other conversations until now. You know, we know each other quite well, but there's a lot of stuff we don't know about each other in that way. You know, what spaces are we going to allow ourselves to go here? And leadership sits in that sort of unknown, how far do I push it, when do I hold back, absolutely. All of that. It's a very nuanced thing. Whereas I reckon a lot of the leadership we grew up with tended to be pretty matter of fact, pretty black and white. It's either this or that.
Yes.
Whereas you live in the place of nuance, really, don't you?
Oh, I think by nature the system I work in I could tell people what to do, but I don't actually have that level of power over them. So it is quite nuanced how to get a system to work together.
Get the dynamic right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, influence. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Build trust.
It is influence.
Yeah, yeah, those sorts of things. And how do you balance this over, because you've lived elite sport both personally but also, you know, through your husband Shane, who, for those who don't know Shane Kelly, five-time Olympian.
Yep.
And I think you guys were together for at least a couple of those campaigns. How has that experience informed you, or hasn't it?
Oh, I think it has. And there's probably moments where I self-check, is that the industry view or is that a very individualized personal view?
As in his view?
Yeah, or even when I'm formulating thinking on things, is that based on what I've heard from the industry, or is that based on what I've heard at home over a couple, as you pointed out, over a couple of Olympic cycles? So I always check and challenge that, because it would absolutely not be useful if it was just that personal view in isolation.
Yeah.
But it absolutely has shaped what I think. I have my husband now is a coach, a Paralympic coach. Mm-hmm. They recently won a gold medal at Paris, set a world record. That my views on coaching are very formulated from knowing intimately the experience of what it takes to be a coach, the demands on that. So absolutely, I'd be lying not to say that those personal experiences haven't shaped my views of the industry, but I've got to make sure I check and challenge it.
Mm. And I'm also thinking about how his endeavours and a world champion to be the best have shaped him.
Absolutely.
And now your experiences of life beyond his days in competition as well.
I said at the start, elite sport is not for everyone. It takes – if you're an athlete, I used to when I was practicing call it healthy selfish, and that's not the right word in hindsight, but it is a laser focus, and you do – if you're going to be the best in the world, you do need to have skills and strategies where – you just put all the other stuff aside. You just, and potentially from the non-elite sport person, that will seem like selfishness. But it's not. It's a way to move things away so you know what you need to do in order to get that performance. So you can see how that's not always compatible with families, relationships, yeah, etc. Because we don't all live in that world.
No, Laura Burns talked about that when she was on the podcast, even having to make weight, for example, yeah, you know, in taekwondo, you know, where she fought at, I think it was like 7 or 8 kilos
lighter
than a natural weight. Absolutely. And we're talking, yep, into the 40s, you, yep, know, like jockey,
yep,
you know. And obviously I saw the wonderful documentary your husband did last year where he spoke of, you know, there's probably, I don't know however many famous stories, certainly of my generation, but the Shane Kelly story is one of them, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And without, and you take it as far as you'd like, but was that a conversation that he had with the world that perhaps was waiting to happen for some period of time?
I think so. He that was before, that was 96. Before he and I were together. But I think it was that was a great moment for him to reflect. That changed his whole life.
No,
not for the worse.
Just explain, yeah, again, for those, there might be a few younger people in the room. I remember very, as a cyclist now, and certainly not, it's just someone who gets on a bike compared, but the whole world was basically watching your husband, yeah, in that moment, the whole of Australia was. Yeah. Yeah.
So at the Games was touted to win a gold medal.
He's world champion.
Current world champion, yeah, touted to win the gold medal, and the strap snapped.
Yeah, at the very start of the race.
Start of the,
yeah,
race, within, done and dusted.
Yeah, within.
No restart
point,
then.
0.02 of a second, yeah, yeah, and he carries that forward. And I think he wins the world championship.
A month later. Yeah,
a month later, yeah. Yeah, yeah, and so he's coming out and talking to his experience, just humanised, I think, probably a generation of athletes who find it very difficult to talk to their experiences of the disappointments that inevitably elite sport will come your way.
And elite sport is not perfect. No. It's not without challenges. And yes, that was on the world stage, but he's a better human being for it.
Yes. And we all are if we deal with it in vaguely healthy ways, aren't
yeah,
we?
Correct, like correct, yeah.
And so your experiences, you know, in terms of dealing with, and I'm sure any of your experiences, say through the players' associations or whatever, I would imagine many of your conversations, if not most of your conversations, would be about dealing with the hardship of
absolutely
that sport will provide.
Absolutely, yeah. You can't have the golden moments without some pretty crappy moments along the way, but that's that's what elite sport is about. And I think, you talk about that moment, but let's say Shane had have won a gold, he probably wouldn't be the person he is now. Well, he wouldn't be.
No, he'd be different.
He would be different because he's had a different view of the world. Mm. That's sport.
Yes.
And I think it's how you manage your way through that stuff. It teaches you so much. Sport teaches you so much more than just the performance.
Yeah. No, I'm just so pleased he spoke to it.
Yeah.
it was almost like a conversation 30 years in the
absolutely. And I think he says he hadn't watched it that before, that moment.
Oh, that's right. He did too. Yeah. He hadn't actually gone back and watched that 0.2 of a second.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. No, incredible. And I'm sure that there's, you know, of all the experiences that you have and the insight that all of the conversations you've had with elite athletes and often at a time where they're just forming as people, and now you're sitting with your sort of hands on the levers in regard to having the indirect responsibility. How have those experiences is in terms of what you bring as a leader, not just in terms of your personal approach to leadership, but your overarching values that you actually think of
I'm very clear on this. I think Australian high-performance sport, not everyone will win a gold medal, whether you're a coach, athlete, but our responsibility is to have a system and a culture which everyone who leaves it, whether it's 4 years, 8 years, 12 years, is better off as a result of their time in elite sport. I fundamentally believe that. Because
is
if it's
it
just
possible?
Absolutely. Because if it's just about the gold medals, we're going to have a whole heap of people leaving our system without that and what they've failed and they can't contribute to society. Yeah. We should absolutely strive to have a system where people leave saying, I'm better off as a result of it. I learnt this about myself. I learnt this skill. I've got these, I've met these amazing people. I had these performances, whatever it is. But we absolutely should strive for that. And it is possible. It's about being clear around what success looks like. And it is absolutely more than the handful of people who will win a gold medal.
How are those athletes? So we've had the most successful games ever.
Yep.
How did it feel when we tipped into the at least equaling the previous? How did that feel for you?
When we got equal, I felt relieved.
Yeah. Not excited, not elated. No, just relieved.
Just relieved. And then once we surpassed that, I thought, this is excellent.
Yeah.
But when we hit equal, it was relief because 2 years ago we asked or we got the system together and the system decided to sign up to one and the first ever National High Performance Strategy. That's a big ask. We've never done it before. We've always had organisational strategies but not one Australian strategy.
Right.
So for the system to get behind that was a big, big deal. And there were probably a couple of significant moments where that would be tested, and absolutely Paris was going to be one of those that was going to be tested. So it was just relief when we hit equal.
Yeah. So that was your Cathy Freeman moment in some ways. You just sat down on the track and just said, oh, thank goodness.
I went to my hotel room and I just was relieved.
I often found that relief. Yeah. I found winning often was relief. Every so often you have an unexpected win, you know, where – you know, and that was normally because you were poor and you had a win you didn't see coming, and there was almost a certain almost joy in that. But most of the time, you know, in my experience of elite sport, is winning's mostly relief.
Yeah.
Which is sort of sad in some ways, but that's how it felt. Yeah.
I hadn't sort of thought through what that experience was going to be like. And absolutely, do I say that the high performance strategy was the sole thing that contributed to the performance? Absolutely not, because there were some really great decisions done well and truly before my time that absolutely accumulated in that performance by the sports and the and particularly the athletes and coaches. But I just felt relief because to do something a little bit different for a system is pretty courageous for those people in the system to do that.
Yeah.
And you've got a 101 teaching, how do you keep reinforcing behaviours? And that was going to be one of those moments. Is this going to reinforce working together, or is it going to be a question mark for people? Why did we work together?
No, that's good. People needed evidence almost. They needed to feel it. And so we think it's a good idea, but it needs to get some rubber on the road and some medals around necks. How would it feel if you were an athlete now who competed in Paris and you finished fifth in your event?
Oh, I think there's still a feel of failure for many of them. I do think that. Not for all of them, because I one thing that I did love hearing when I got back to Australia was the general public talking about some of the stories of athletes who had not won a medal but who actually had inspired people. I thought that is a shift. Like, they were talking about what their performance meant for them and that they were proud of that. That is a big shift, but I still think there would be a large number that felt like they have failed. It makes them question, do they go round again? Can they hang in there till Brisbane? Is it all worth it? Is it worth the impact on my family, friends, et cetera? So we've still got a heap of work to do on that. I'm not certain we should shy away from that feeling for those people at that point in time. That's not a bad thing at that point in time. It's how long it lasts then, because there are a few athletes that would turn up just to turn up, if any. Yeah. They turn up
to an expectation to perform. And, absolutely. And even if they did, it's hard to be best in the world. And
Correct. So yeah. I hope over time that emotion and sentiment changes, and I think we do a better job of that shifting. But it's okay to be upset. It's okay to be disappointed. That's a normal reaction.
Yeah, it sort of brings me back to one of my favourite Neil Danaher lines, which is the game does not give up its rewards easily. You know, what we're asking people to do is very difficult.
It is.
And we achieve extraordinarily based on ideas around population and all that, but we certainly benefit from the privilege that we have in regard to, I mean, other things. So it's, I know that's only just one dimension of it, is in support of people who are trying to do something very difficult. My sense is that if there's greater acknowledgement for all the things that it actually asks of them and the value that that now brings to the world in other ways. And I remember having this conversation. There was a young guy at Melbourne. His name's Jack Grimes, and he was appointed captain at only 22. And we asked too much of him probably at the time. And as it turned out, we asked more of him than what we expected because he had a terrible run with injuries. And so he was never able to get himself into the place where he could perform to his capability. And his brother Dylan ends up being captain of Richmond, plays in 3 premierships. And I remember when Jack retired, he felt this overwhelming sense of that the game he hadn't achieved from the game what he would have ever expected. And the challenge for him was to be able to communicate to the world the value that he now brings through those experiences rather than through he was the bloke who was made captain of Melbourne at 22 and only played X amount of games, because he's one of the best young blokes I'd ever met in the game, and would bring an extraordinary amount to whatever environment that he would find himself in whenever that was to happen. And it, for me, it's almost like not just equipping the individual, but actually being able to explain what extraordinary things people are able to do, what great things they offer, you know, whether it's the individual athlete or the team-based athlete in regard to life beyond that.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about, because you often hear the sentiment, the skills of an elite athlete, they'd be great for a corporate environment, yet both industries can't articulate what that is.
Yeah.
So we need to, and we have started doing this, we need to do a better job of athletes and coaches being clear on that articulation and also corporate understanding. When they say that, what are you actually referring to? What are the competencies and capability you're talking about? And I think it's creating that common language, which is actually not different to when I decided to do the exec MBA. I thought they're worlds apart. I don't know what's going on. Once I understood what the language was, it was about finding that common thread there. I think we've got to do that, do the same piece.
Yeah, language, that's a really good way of thinking of it. Because even in, and I've used it on this podcast before, but, you know, the first question I ask people in job interviews is, what's something you've taught yourself? And what's the best thing you've ever made? You know, questions along those lines. Because what you're trying to get to is ideas around coachability and self-responsibility. Yep. And you sit in the role now because of those things. Not because the fact that you went and did yourself an executive MBA in the midst of having twin girls and all of that craziness.
Might have been to get away from them for a bit, but
and it probably was, But all of the elements of your life which actually would all add up in their own way, which wouldn't necessarily be contributing in the way that you thought that doing an executive MBA was about, you know, the skills that you would learn in things. And probably you don't get as much out of that as what you actually thought, but what it's shown you is you're someone who's serious about being the best you can be. You're someone who's serious about what you bring in regard to, if you ever get to play the role that you're now playing, that you'll bring the best of yourself, that you're someone who can show resilience at times when it gets really, really hard and it's very easy. When you've got an assignment due, you know, tomorrow and you haven't opened the book yet, I'm sure those days actually happened for you. You know, all of the experiences that you've had, of which elite sport gives you that every single day of the week. And I can only make comparisons with people I know who haven't gone through those experiences, and I think eventually they catch up in that sense if they're made of the same stuff. But these guys are doing it at between the ages of 12 and 20, you know, in that way. Yeah, and even say with Shane, to have something, so that's 1996. How old is he when that career defining thing happens?
He'd be mid-20s.
Mid-20s. So a life-defining thing happens in his mid-20s, and he needs to carry that forward and all the lessons that it's actually brought in regard to it. And being able to talk to that and articulate it in the way you can, that we it ends up being, whilst the roads that we take and yours has certainly never been straight line in that way, or point you in the right direction because of the human characteristics that you've actually built and created for yourself, that you know that, you know, you've got, Neil Craig described it really well, we've got to have like a performance ego. Well, I've got this ego, but we also need to have the quiet ego working away as well. Yeah. And you've shown both.
I like that idea of a performance ego and the quiet ego.
Did the performance ego take a little bit of doing for you? The quiet ego was clearly there, I think, in the learner and the grower and the...
Well, I think mine looks different. I am ambitious, but it's not because I've always wanted to what's the next thing I can do, et cetera, but it's not been a clear, well, I'm going to do this to get to this to get to this because that's the end goal. But I am ambitious. Like if I'm doing something, I want to be the best in the world at doing it. And I think that was clear when I moved into the area of setting up wellbeing services. I wanted that to be. I want to be known as the best in the world for setting up wellbeing services in elite sport.
Yeah. It's interesting because I hear you speak and I try to differentiate a little bit. And might I hope it doesn't seem like I'm splitting hairs with it. But to be ambitious versus having ambitions for a bit different, you know.
Yep.
I think we go through a phase where we naturally have to be ambitious to get good at something. And I think something sort of flicks, some little switch flicks at some point in life. And I think parenting's part of it, perhaps.
Yep.
But not necessarily. Is we stop from... It's because some people still remain ambitious. They're ambitious for their kids, you know, that it's more about them.
Yes.
And you'd see that all the time in sport, no doubt. Rather, and just flicking into this idea of ambitions for, like I have ambitions for, you know, the Institute of Sport. I have ambitions for the people who work in our team. I have ambitions for the athletes. I have ambitions for my children. I have ambitions for, you know, my husband and my partner. These sorts of ideas and that little flick of the switch for me was quite important, you know, and I don't know if that you can relate to that.
No, I think absolutely. I think there's also there's been another grapple in my head over time because there has been I think there is a view amongst some that if you're a female and you're ambitious, that somehow is a bad thing.
Yeah,
versus if you're a male and you're ambitious, you're a goer and good on you, et cetera. But if you're a female and you're ambitious, watch them.
Yeah.
So I stopped using the word ambitious and then I thought, well, no, I am ambitious, but I like the ambition for absolutely.
Yeah. See, again, this is just a perspective that I've never had to think about. To actually be, there's not one person at any point in my life who would have judged me for being ambitious. But you've had to deal with that, Em.
Yeah.
I think a little bit of the I'm the son of, because I had to cop that a little bit early because my father was well known and a high achiever. But mostly, you know, and every so often people might say, oh, he's too ambitious. You can always cop a bit of that, but not in the judgment you're talking to.
Yeah.
So what did it feel like to be you in those times?
Well, I think there's... And it might have been what I created in my own mind, the dialogue, but it felt that you're ambitious at the cost of. So is it at the cost of your family? Is it a cost of those poor little twins that, you know, they're going to be homeless, they're going to be motherless? Well, they've actually got a father as well, but, you know, and so it's at the cost of their development. It's at the cost of your broader relationship and or almost like don't get too big for your boots.
And I
think that don't get too big for your boots is something that I hear now and again. So I believe in humbleness and humility. And I think that's a core value. To be humble is really important. But did that come about because of that little don't get too big for your boots? Whereas I think now that's actually a core value, and I think that's hugely helpful. But I do wonder whether it came from that early origins were don't get too big for your boots.
Yeah, and I really feel for you on that, because it is it's a belief just built totally on the basis of a bias and prejudice.
Absolutely.
So there's no other way of thinking about it really in that sense. And the interesting thing is to hold the two things simultaneously. And one of the complexities of leadership is to be often to hold two ideas which seem in some ways contradictory at the same time. Like, I can be humble, I can be ambitious.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can plan for the future but look after the present. I can sow seeds and take risks but also make sure that we've covered, you know, other important areas to, you know, that the, you know, if I smell smoke, check whether there's a fire type mindset, you know, that almost the nuance of leadership, which you've had to hold quite personally, is the capacity to hold two ideas at the same time and be okay with it.
Yeah.
You know, that that I'm going to be ambitious about what I can be and have ambitions for, but you can be really comfortable in holding the two ideas at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I've got more comfortable with what people would see as nuances or conflictual ideas. And it comes back to, I think, where we started. I'm okay with being a people-oriented. I don't have to be the smartest person in the room, but I'm still quite okay to make a decision.
Yeah, and that's what you're expected to do.
Absolutely,
that's the job.
And they're not mutually exclusive ideas. Yeah. I can be a mum of 13-year-old twins and still be the first female to be AIS director.
Yeah.
And my kids aren't suffering, and I can still travel a couple of days a week. They're not mutually exclusive ideas.
In actual fact.
That's made me better and vice versa.
Yeah, probably meant you've just worked harder to be better at both, you know, in that sense.
Yeah.
Whereas you mightn't have done that had you not have done that.
Correct.
If you know what I mean, in that sense. Well, I've loved this conversation. If you got, and I've a question without notice, because I normally give you a bit of, if you've got a question for me, has anything come to mind, you know, in regard to some little idea of being, because the whole concept is this idea of being in the arena, and the arena promises many things, doesn't always promise to be fair. You know, we know that. Yeah, so, and we've all experienced that. Yeah, anything come to mind for me?
Even in our pre-conversation, so you've been CEO of multiple organisations and now you take a coaching role. What's the more enjoyable?
I miss the game, like at a pure level. And I've got to be careful, because if I'm going to judge the rest of my life by the fact that I miss the game, well, it's going to be – so that aspect of it, I miss. The pure ideas around coaching, I don't think there's anything – I can't think of anything which actually surpasses it in the way that we're talking to. And I think it's probably the same thing which drew you to the clinical aspect of it, that you actually get to be a very important person in someone's life and someone's existence, mostly as it relates to the work they're trying to do, the people who are attracted to coaching, people like myself in coaching, are people who are trying to create great conditions for their organisations and are struggling because that's hard to do. And with all balancing all the things we've talked about today, commercial imperatives with performance ideals, all those sorts of things. And to know that you're the just break glass person for them at different times, or you're the person who can help them with a system or a way of thinking, or help them build out an idea. You could be the truth teller at different times.
Pretty special.
Yeah, it can be a really important role. So I've got to remind myself that that's a, you know, and I shouldn't have to, but I do have to remind myself that the that's I've got to have enormous gratitude for that. The same way as I've got this enormous gratitude for the fact that I got to play the role in the game that I did for as long as I did. I had 25 years of CEOing, so it was a long time. But I think there's just pure elements of that environment that sort of still run through my veins a little bit, which I do miss. And but I'm just, you know, I'm eternally grateful, and I'm always looking to get better at the craft that I'm now trying to get good at, which is, you know, helping people from a coaching perspective. Yeah. So thanks very much, Maddie. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's great to see you again. And I'm just so pleased that the way that your career's evolved and developed, and I remember having some conversations probably a decade or so ago now about some of the challenges you were facing to try and convince the world that people such as yourself with the backgrounds that you had could bring something special to leadership. And the one thing you've done now is you've well and truly convinced the world that that's actually possible. So thanks very much. Thank you. It's been a beauty.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Maddie Clements. I know that I certainly did. I've known Maddie for a long time, and it was amazing sitting in front of her and just seeing the development and the growth. And in no way does that surprise me, knowing the person that she is. But the confidence and belief that she brings makes her just a wonderful role model of courage and commitment to leading in a way which is a pure extension of who you are, and that's what you get when you spend time with Maddie. There are a few other insights which emerge from our conversations which I'd like to share with you. Firstly, the idea of authenticity not being a starting point, but it's an outcome in many ways of choosing courage over comfort, which again she's just modeled so well, to be the first of a profound kind, both as a psychologist and a woman who's had to work so hard when, you know, really in many ways fighting in a very embedded, you know, let's call it out for what it is, a bias as it relates to both the her qualifications and background, but also her gender in that way. The second insight that came to mind was that ideas of belonging and well-being are fundamental to sustained success. And in many ways, culture isn't a gift you receive, but it's a skill you learn, and the leaders must be the people who are doing the learning first. And what stands out, you know, from Maddie's story is how creating the conditions for belonging and well-being aren't in any way separate from performance, in fact, essential to it. Her journey shows that leadership isn't fitting into any sort of predetermined moulds of what it should look like, but having the courage to bring your whole self to the role. And if the arena reveals who you are, Maddie's story shows us, then when people belong to something greater than their own self-interest, they can create something magical. And there's a wonderful Stephen Covey line which goes something along the lines that while we may judge ourselves by our own intentions, others will always experience our behaviours, and Maddie's behaviours just speak volumes. In the podcast, Maddie said something along the line that elite sport is not for everyone, but I can say with conviction that it's definitely for her. It was great to have her joining us in the arena, and I hope you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. Stay tuned.